From WXXI News and the Innovation Trail, this is Healthy Friday. Hello, this is Matthew Leonard from the Innovation Trail, and I'm joined by my colleague Michelle Faust from WXSI News for the second part of Healthy Friday. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
For the next hour or so, we'll be joined by a number of guests involved in or understanding and or delivering healthcare to our rural communities. We know that there are particular challenges for people living in rural communities accessing healthcare services. Higher rates of chronic illness, the tyranny of distance, changing demographics, and sometimes limited choices in health insurance all figure in the conversation. And later in this hour, we'll look a bit more at how the implementation of the Affordable Care Act is affecting our rural communities, and we'd value your input and experience. And if you're able to visit the WXXI News Facebook page, you'll see an informative infographic that compares average premiums for various levels of healthcare coverage across different regions in New York State. That's something we'll return to in the second half hour. Joining me, a range of guests who've got expertise and some valuable insights. With us in studio, Dr. Daniel Mendelson. Dr. Mendelson is an associate professor in the Department of Medicine at Highland Hospital here in Rochester. He's with the Division of Geriatrics, and he also specialises in geriatric and palliative care. On the phone from Maine is Erica Ziller. Erica is the Senior Research Associate and Deputy Director at the Maine Rural Health Research Center at the Muskie School of Public Service. Erica, how are you doing today?
Well, thank you.
Great. Thanks very much for joining us. And from the Finger Lakes region and the South, I think he's on the Southern Tier, James Kennedy. James is the Chief Compliance and Program Development Officer for Finger Lakes Community Health, and he's speaking with us today, more wearing the hat of the Secretary of the New York State Association for Rural Health. Jim, thanks very much for your time today.
Hi, Matthew. Hey, everyone.
Thanks very much. You're down in the Southern Tier by the looks of it.
Well, yes. Technically, we're really in the heart of the Finger Lakes, talking to you from Ovid, New York, which is in southern Seneca County in a health center that serves Seneca, Schuyler, and Tompkins counties.
Great. Great to have your perspective from there. Thanks for joining us. So what we wanted to do is, Erica Ziller, I might start with you. Erica is also the chapter of a new chapter in a book called Access to Medical Care in Rural America. It's part of a new book called Rural Public Health, Best Practices and Preventive Models. It's new from Springer Publishing. Erica, in your chapter, you really look at some of the general challenges about accessing medical care in rural America. What were some of the things that you kind of identified as being key issues in your overview chapter?
Well, there definitely are a number of challenges that rural people face compared to their urban counterparts when it comes to getting healthcare services. And first and foremost is health insurance coverage. Rural people have tended to have lower rates of insurance coverage, higher uninsured rates, and they've also, even when they had coverage, had to pay a lot more out of pocket for the coverage in terms of premiums and also for their basic healthcare services. So that's certainly an issue. Second primary issue is access to providers. It's, I'm sure, not a surprise to your audience or to the people in the studio that rural people have a lot fewer healthcare providers, either primary care providers or other specialty care providers in their communities actually practicing there. And that means that rural people have to travel long distances sometimes upward of an hour to get to their primary care provider, and that makes it really difficult to get the care that you need, especially if you can't get there during the day when they have office hours and other things like that. So number of significant challenges that rural people face.
So is there something in the culture can there be something in the culture of the way in which services are delivered that are kind of that sort of contraindicate people having access to them? So you mentioned if they have office hours or hours that maybe don't really work for people involved in rural activities, that's obviously can be a barrier to participation.
Absolutely, and it's so much more difficult for rural providers, primary care physicians, for example, to have expansive office hours. They tend to be in small practices much more. They tend to often practice alone, and so to keep your office hours open late is really a challenge, and it's a huge burden in communities where there's just one or two providers to try to fit around people's schedules in the way that a large urban center can much more easily accommodate through walk-in clinics or, you know, Saturday hours or late hours.
Right. Jim Kennedy, so Erica Ziller there is talking about access to services or, you know, to treatment. What about preventative delivery of preventative healthcare as well? Is there a similar story there? What's your perspective?
Well, actually, while Erica was speaking, the one that came to mind is diseases or health problems from the shoulders up, which tend to get either forgotten or under-reimbursed, and that's mental health and dental health. For dental health, a preventative issue in our regions are, unlike many of our urban counterparts or even suburban counterparts, is the lack of fluoridation in the water.
Right.
So that, coupled with workforce capacity gaps, major gaps in provision of dental care and very low levels of dentists taking Medicaid or any kind of public insurance, all of these are characteristic of the access to dental care, and the same goes for mental health. These are two very significant, although largely invisible, public health issues in rural areas: access to dental and mental health care.
So, Dr. Daniel Mendelson nodding there in agreement with Jim. Dr. Mendelson, obviously, partly in the business of facilitating mental health care services remotely and in rural areas. What are your thoughts on? I mean, I guess the kind of general picture from your point of view, and what are the challenges that you're trying to address?
Yeah, it's obviously very hard to bring services to the patients or to bring the patients to services. Both, either way you look at it, it's hard. And trying to attract competent medical providers to low resource areas is very much a challenge, and becoming more and more important as we form these big networks and are trying to actually manage whole populations. Our obligations to take models that have worked in a more resource-rich environment and then actually get the same quality outcomes in a lower resource environment is very hard.
So you sort of, is it the case that you sort of sometimes trying to back engineer programs or techniques that are being developed within the clinical environment, a dense clinical environment?
Absolutely. If you take geriatric dentistry, for instance, at Monroe Community Hospital with the Eastman Dental Center, we have pioneered a model for care, dental care for geriatric patients that's not matched by anybody anywhere. So we know how to do a wonderful job. How do you bring that to a rural nursing home in Schuyler County? It's probably impossible to do that, yet we know that it makes a difference for these patients' lives.
Right. Erica Ziller, I think also in your observations you talk about just the general demographic makeup of, you know, predominantly rural counties, you know, things like the age, the kind of older population generally. What are some of the other sort of demographic indicators that, you know, inform our conversation about rural healthcare delivery?
Absolutely. Certainly, rural populations do tend to be older. A lot of this is because young people, when they are looking for economic opportunity, are more likely to move into urban areas, leave their homes where they grew up, and you end up with a lot of older populations that have a lot of healthcare needs. Rural people, even of the same ages, tend to have more chronic health conditions. They are, as you mentioned earlier, less likely to use preventive resources, and they tend to be more likely to have poor health habits such as smoking or lack of physical activity, et cetera. So they're generally a little bit sicker than urban populations. And they tend to have less formal education and definitely lower incomes. And so when you add all of those things together, you know, the demographics certainly compound the problems with access and with being healthy generally.
And they present later in the course of disease. So
absolutely.
Yeah, so where we might see a breast cancer at stage one in Brighton coming from rural America, they might present at stage three or stage four, where either there's much less that we can do for them or the cost of care is tremendously higher.
Is that sort of like, is it just a question of a kind of stoicism, or is there some way that we can kind of characterize the, what would be the motivations for people presenting much later in their condition?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. It's the more access you have, the more likely you are to access. So if you're not seeing a primary care doctor for your diabetes, you're probably not going to get reminded to have your mammogram or your colonoscopy. If you're not, so they don't present until they have a lot of symptoms that they can't ignore.
Right. Sorry, Michelle had.
Yeah, I just wanted to back up a little bit. Erica Ziller, you had mentioned an increase in just chronic illness, and I want you to kind of maybe expand on that. And what does that necessarily mean later on if they're not getting preventative care?
Well, some of this could be a result of preventive care, of lack of preventive care. So things like, diabetes, when you're in, and I'm not a medical professional, so somebody else might be better able to answer this, but, you have a lot of markers leading up to the point where you get diabetes, and if you're receiving routine preventive services, then there's a chance that between you and your relationship with your provider, you can figure out ways to actually prevent getting the full-fledged illness. And rural people, if they're not getting those services, and if they, tend to be obese and overweight at higher rates, and they're not physically active, this combination of factors is going to lead them to be sicker.
Jim Kennedy, can you chime in on chronic illness and what that means for rural areas?
Very much so. Something that Erica said is, if you look at education levels, you can also see a related pattern in poor health behaviors. We are, not unlike our urban counterparts in the rural areas, also a victim of food deserts, which means that we have very poor access to high-quality, healthy food. Too many people rely on convenience stores for their shopping in rural areas. The stores are closing, many of them. So you have less shopping, and again, this is very similar to what's happened in the inner cities in terms of access to food, and of course food is part of a healthy lifestyle, healthy behavior, good food. And secondly, I would just add that when you are, we have opportunities, however, something that Dr. Mendelson said that I would like to just add, and that is we have a teledental program that we also work with Eastman Dental Center with, which prevents particularly children having to go from these very rural areas, sometimes 2 hours from the rural area to get into some very complicated, quote-unquote, parts of Rochester by car, so that a oral health exam can be done from our office using what is, in effect, a very thick, large toothbrush with the camera at the end, so that that child's oral health problem can be seen in advance and diagnosed, and that can reduce the number of trips preoperative trips that they have to make to Eastman for that care.
First of all, the kids are going to love that. That must just be the one incentive. If you're ever having trouble getting your kid to the dentist, the idea that there's this huge camera in their mouth, that's probably the linchpin to your program, don't you think, Jim?
Yes, absolutely. And so I think, we're talking health, we're talking medical, but I think also in the conversation that all of us are having, the social determinants in the rural areas, whether they're physical, cultural, are so significant. And even though there's fewer people here, to count at least, the health problems are real, as are the barriers.
Well, the surgical robots can actually be operated remotely. Traditionally, they're operated in the same operating theater, but you could see they actually, in battlefield situations, they have been operated remotely, and you could actually maybe even figure out how to do a dental procedure remotely so that the expert technician doesn't have to physically be present. You just have to have the device present. That would be an interesting model to expand rural healthcare.
Indeed. If you've just joined us, just to recap, you're with Healthy Friday. I'm Matthew Leonard from the Innovation Trail, and I'm with my colleague Michelle Faust from WXXI News. In the studio, Dr. Daniel Mendelson from Highland Hospital, and on the phone, James Kennedy, who's from in his capacity as Secretary of the New York State Association for Rural Health, and from Maine, Erica Ziller, who's the Deputy Director at the Maine Rural Health Research Center. By the way, you can go to the XXI news page. We've got an interesting infographic there comparing and contrasting average premium costs for healthcare coverage, something we're going to come back to and talk about in about 10, 15 minutes in a bit more detail. At the moment, we're really looking at the challenges for rural healthcare delivery. What are the kinds of predeterminant factors that can influence and set up barriers for accessing quality healthcare generally? Jim Kennedy, I know that I wanted to ask you a little bit about the role of these entities called accountable care organizations and how they kind of, what sort of role you see them having in terms of addressing issues associated with rural care. Can you just tell people what accountable care organizations do?
Right now, I've heard them likened to mermaids. We know they exist, but we just haven't seen them yet,
right.
especially in New York State. For all intents and purposes, right now, we are seeing the typical accountable care organization really is a Medicare model, and Medicare tends to be more inpatient than outpatient, which is what we do here at our health center in Ovid, New York. But suffice to say that there is a program now in New York State called the Delivery System Reform Incentive Program, also known as DSRIP, which sounds very much like disrupt, which is intended to level the playing field for patients who are on public assistance, who are on, I should say, public insurance, namely Medicaid, with the overriding goal of reducing inappropriate, unnecessary hospitalizations by 25% over the next 5 years. This requires all healthcare providers, upstream and downstream from the emergency room, to align their data, align their practitioners to look at less costly ways of providing care, and which has already been said on this program so far, focusing on primary care, monitoring of patients, calling back patients, especially those with chronic illnesses, so that they can be monitored and so that their tendency, their default healthcare provider, which is all too often the emergency room, that visit is prevented and that they come back and see their regular provider, or they're involved in some, like a social program that we here at Finger Lakes Community Health offer, which is a national best standard known as chronic disease self-management, the Stanford model, which promotes the idea of partnership and self-management of your chronic disease, thereby reducing the reliance, over-reliance too often with the population that we're talking about, an over-reliance on visiting with a healthcare provider, which can be very costly and sometimes unnecessary.
Right. So, Erica Zilla, ACOs, did they figure in your kind of overview of rural healthcare?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Just accountable care organizations. Are they sort of characters or actors in your overview of delivery of rural healthcare?
Well, I believe there are some accountable care organizations that are serving rural areas, but to have the sort of infrastructure that you need to really mount these types of you know, service entities, you tend to need a lot more population and a lot more healthcare providers. So in rural communities, if a small rural hospital is affiliated with a larger urban hospital, perhaps a critical access hospital that has a parent organization in the urban center, and enough primary care providers on the ground to really, you know, make this model work, then those rural communities, they're starting to see some ACO activity, as I understand it. But some of the most remote, you know, frontier counties, that's just not something.
It's just too much of a challenge. Dr. Mendelson. Yeah.
Well, so that's the University of Rochester model. So we have our tertiary and quaternary care hospitals here in the city, but we're partnering with multiple hospitals in more rural communities. And that's advantageous to both the rural communities as well as the tertiary care centers. As we go to managing the population rather than fee for service, we need a bigger catchment area of patients that need services to draw from. And so, and we benefit by covering those patients and bringing them services. So now, even though it may be expensive to bring the service to the patient, as long as it decreases their overall utilization of the population, it benefits everybody. So those strong partnerships, no pun intended, but those strong partnerships are really important to the success of an ACO. You have to have a large enough population to share the risk over and to ultimately share the benefits over.
Right. Jim Kennedy, I wanted to ask you about the district programs that the Association for Rural Health are becoming involved in. Could you just sort of walk us through how those programs potentially change the landscape?
Well, it really is a work in progress, and because we're in a rural area, we here at Finger Lakes Community Health are participating in no less than 3 DISRIP programs that are really developing as we speak. Fortunately, in the Rochester region, our 2 main acute care hospital providers have come together to form 1 DISRIP program. That's not the same in the other regions. So what is happening, and I think it's both fascinating and challenging, is we are looking at how we can better serve this population in a more accountable, less costly way. And it is interesting in that I think the hospitals are fully learning what it is federally qualified health centers do, which is what Finger Lakes Community Health does throughout Finger Lakes and in part of Central New York. And we, in turn, are learning about new models where, for example, primary care can be provided within the emergency room, so that that visit, which might be inappropriate for the emergency room, but the person has no medical home, that visit can be dealt with in an appropriate manner at that time, without turning somebody away, of course, but directing them in the right direction, and then having them follow up with a medical home, such as a community health center. So we're hearing more about medical homes, which is more than just episodic care. The other feature of this, which is something that we've been doing for years, both with our community patients and the migrant and seasonal farm workers in the region that we serve and have served for many years, is the key role that care management or case management plays in not only delivering the care, but, and this is particularly important with the newly insured people under the Affordable Care Act, basically teaching people how to become compliant with their health insurance, keeping people coming back for care, and reinforcing prevention rather than having them either become insured and then forget about their insurance, but teaching them how to become true partners in their care.
I wanted to ask a question about that migrant population since you brought it up. How do you have that care management for a group that, when you're talking about especially migrant farm workers, many of them don't qualify for affordable care, they don't qualify for health insurance, so they may not have any insurance at all, and then they're also a moving, by migrant population, they're moving all the time. How do we keep some sort of care management for a group like that?
Well, to begin with, that population has more in common with our community population, who are largely uninsured as well, than they differ from our current population. We are seeing that our rural communities are becoming increasingly more diversified, so we, at all of our health centers, hire staff who are bilingual, Spanish and English speaking. So rather than differentiate that population, they really have more in common. Yes, they're a little bit harder to reach geographically, and they are seasonal. But we do see with our populations in our communities that there's quite a bit of movement from one home to another, from one county to another. And again, many of the people that we serve, if they're not on a commercial insurance program, and many of them are, then they are uninsured. And so this district program that I mentioned before is, just as of last week, the Department of Health indicated that the uninsured now are also going to be considered Medicaid-like, so to speak, in being included in this district program, which I do want to attach it to the actual question that was asked of me before, which is these district models will eventually become accountable care organizations. It's designed for the Medicaid population.
Okay. And Erica Ziller, we were talking about migrant farm workers, but also you mention in the chapter of your book, the chapter that you contributed to the book about the doubling of the permanent resident Latino population, particularly in the Midwest. How is that kind of changing the kind of opportunities and challenges for healthcare in rural areas?
Well, certainly that presents a whole new set of challenges for rural providers. Rural populations have tended to be overwhelmingly white compared to urban populations, so white, non-Hispanic. And in recent decades, this has really shifted, and there's been a demographic shift. And so rural communities are much more diverse than they ever used to be. But at the same time, rural providers tend to be much more likely to be white and to not be Hispanic speaking. And that can create a lot of cultural barriers to care for people. And so, programs like the one that Jim was talking about in terms of, having bilingual staff available or other, culturally competent providers is really important to managing the health of these populations.
We're going to take a short break. It's Healthy Friday. I'm Matthew Leonard from the Innovation Trail. Michelle Faust from WXXR News is with me as well. Dr. Daniel Mendelson from Highland Hospital, James Kennedy from the New York State Association for Rural Health, and Erica Ziller from the Maine Rural Health Research Center are all with us as well. We're going to come back, and since Jim particularly talked about the issue around costs of care, we're going to come back and talk a little bit more in depth about the issues to do with health insurance coverage, premium costs, pharmaceutical gaps, that kind of stuff. That's all coming up on Healthy Friday. Stay with us.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
That's a missed opportunity as well as NCAA.
And we're back with Healthy Friday on WXXI. I'm Michelle Faust, hosting today alongside Matthew Leonard, editor of the Innovation Trail. If you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 844-295-8255-844-295-TALK. You can join the conversation about healthcare, and you can also do that online as well. WXXI and the Innovation Trail are working on a long-term reporting project called Understanding the Affordable Care Act. You can help us with that project. Go to WXXI.org and click the ACA survey link. You don't have to have any questions about rural insurance premiums, but if you have questions about that, go ahead and ask a question there. You may be uninsured and have questions about how to get insurance and some things that have been blocks to getting care. Or maybe you're a business owner who wants to know more about your options. Take the survey or send us an email, acawxxi@wxxi.org, or call 585-258-0263.
And just during that break, Dr. Mendelson was just raising the issue of medical databases and their kind of significance, those assets as a player in particularly keeping track of people who may have itinerant lifestyle or whatever as part of their work.
Right. Or even who are doctor shoppers or switch healthcare systems. Right now, it's often easier and also more profitable to get another test done at a different medical center than it is to go and find the information that's already available somewhere. The point I like to make is that at the end of the day, it's the patient's medical record, not a particular health system's. And data should be shared as much as possible so that we're not reinventing the wheel and not repeating consults and repeating tests and repeating procedures that there's already answers to.
Right, and Jim Kennedy, I assume that's got to be part of best practice and a kind of core business for what, for the way that you're trying to implement reforms and progress.
Yes, Was there a question with that?
No, just, well, okay. Could you give us an example, I guess, of how, say medical data is being significant in the work that you're doing?
Very much so. Health centers, federally qualified and community and rural health centers, which have a special designation known as rural health clinics, have been early adopters of the electronic medical record. Much of that is attributable to the federal support that we received early on. We have had electronic medical records since 2009. As a result of having this technology, we not only have the opportunity, we now have the responsibility, especially because we are what's known as a level 3 patient-centered medical home in most of our health centers. That's a recognition from the National Committee on Quality Assurance, whereby we have to utilize, maximize our use of the technology and of the data to create registries for these chronic illnesses so that we can better track people who have depression, people who have diabetes, and that becomes the springboard for us to, again, as I said earlier, call them back for a follow-up visit, and then also to be able to track and report in an accountable way to our variety of external customers and our payers, track and report how our patients are doing over time, how they're doing, how our diabetics are doing in one health center versus another. So it's very robust and very intriguing, and the technology has required this and challenged us in that way.
Thanks, Jimmy. We're just going to move on to another kind of asset, move a little bit more into health coverage per se, and to sort of set up this conversation, we're going to hear from Catherine Hempstead. Catherine Hempstead is a researcher who directs work on coverage at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Michelle Faust spoke to Catherine yesterday about some research they've done, really kind of capturing a snapshot about accessibility and cost of health insurance in rural communities. And let's hear the first part of that interview.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that's really unique about New York State that, you know, some other states think is a very good model is that they standardize the plan offerings to a considerable extent, you know, so that there's not as much variation in the different kinds of cost sharing or, you know, relationships between the coinsurance and the copay and, you know, this feature or that feature of cost sharing. In some other states, there's really a kind of bewildering array of different kinds of benefit design arrangements for consumers to choose from. So even though things might look very similar in terms of the premium and the deductible, there are a lot of other differences that are hard for consumers to discern. And I know New York State was one state that decided to standardize some of those features so that it's, you know, a lot of people feel that supports consumer choice and makes it easier for consumers to understand what they're buying.
Could you kind of give a little bit of a more specific example of how New York State is compared to these other places that are less standardized?
They haven't let plans have as much different variation in the way they, you know, like how much they charge for a specialist or how much they charge for out-of-network emergency care. I mean, there's an amazing amount of variation in some other states in terms of what those charges are like, and there's no way that a consumer could memorize all that or understand all those differences before they make the choice. And I think in a lot of ways it makes a lot of sense to kind of standardize some of those things. I mean, it remains to be seen kind of at the end of the day. You know, somebody might push back and say, yeah, well, then you don't let carriers try out as many different benefit design types, or you're restricting consumer choice because you're not letting consumers choose from as many different things, you know. But on the other hand, I think that there's a lot to be said for just simplifying the choice, because it's actually a very complex choice, and a lot of the people that are making this choice have never made a choice like this before. I mean, in some ways, we're asking consumers who are, in many cases, have been uninsured or have had very, very little choice, so they're sort of the least familiar with choosing health insurance, and we're actually asking them to make a pretty complicated choice. And in New York State, they've decided to make that choice a little bit less complicated.
That was Catherine Hempstead from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and Erica Ziller kind of picking up on your point about
just the difficulty of people actually navigating or negotiating that, perhaps with having had less access to formal education, etc., and then being having to start participating in these pretty complex sort of decisions as well.
Absolutely. I mean, a big part of what the Affordable Care Act was designed to do was to make an apples-to-apples comparison a lot easier for consumers. And so the whole point of having the different levels of plans, the different medals, as they are called, the bronze and silver, et cetera, was to make it easier for consumers to understand the value of the plan that they're selecting and to compare it in a meaningful way. And prior to the Affordable Care Act, all bets were off for people because it can be really complicated, especially in states that have had very low regulation of health plans, that you could have certain illnesses that just weren't covered, or all kinds of things going on. And so to pick the best plan was very complicated. But even though the Affordable Care Act tried to mitigate some of that, it certainly hasn't been perfect, and plans in different states are doing a number of different things to help keep costs low, including, as Catherine said, varying the costs for out-of-network care, et cetera. A lot of plans are also have been designing extremely narrow networks, so they have very few providers in the network, and so people, thought their providers were going to be in the network because they had been previously, and then, plans draw these really narrow networks, and there's very few providers that you can go to, and that's another way that plans are keeping costs low, and it's not always apparent to people. So that's another thing that's been a challenge.
Jim Kennedy from the New York State Association for Rural Health. Just specifically on the Affordable Care Act, I guess what are the sort of issues that you're seeing in terms of, people's access to plans, having enough choices, being able to make kind of good consumer decisions based on the coverage that's available for them, for example, in the area of the state that you're speaking to us from in the Southern Tier?
Well, being in a health center, we not only provide health care, dental, behavioral, and primary medical care, but we also have certified counselors who are trained to enroll people, and they've been very busy. We have enrolled, I just spoke with one of our counselors last week, we've enrolled close to 1,000 people through the seven counties that we're in.
Yep.
And so, that's one thing to do that, but it's going to be interesting to track how often these people follow up, these new patients, to continue to get care. So it's been very successful, and I think, as everyone on this panel would know, and certainly your listeners, New York has been head and above so many other states in terms of enrollment, and we have not had to rely as heavily on the federal website for enrollment, due to the forward thinking of our Department of Health planning. So it really has been largely, if not entirely, a success story, both in terms of the state, but also in terms of the provider that I represent. We've been very active in doing that.
Eric Azula, did you have any, have any observation about states with a large rural population who were part of the federal exchange or had gone with their own exchange? Whether there were significant differences there?
I know that the research is generally suggesting that states that mounted their own exchange tended to have better take up of insurance and better enrollment. But the really big difference for rural people has tended to be in the states that decided to expand Medicaid and those that didn't. And if you look at the rural population prior to the Affordable Care Act and who was uninsured, rural people were more likely to be uninsured. And the percent of them who were in that income range that was targeted by the Medicaid expansion, so below 133% of poverty, was much higher than the share of the uninsured in urban areas who were at the same income. So the Medicaid expansion should have been a huge boon for rural communities and for rural people. However, as a lot of people may not be surprised to learn, rural people are much less likely to be living in states that have chosen to expand Medicaid. And so as a result, there's this pretty big disparity, particularly in a lot of the southern states and among African-American communities, where people would have been eligible for Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, but the fact that this became optional for states as a result of the Supreme Court decision has basically meant that they are not eligible. And that's been a real problem.
Right. And in fact, Michelle, you've been reporting on some cases where there are some funds who are actually dropping the Medicaid coverage as a part of the options that they've got. We've seen that in Western New York.
We've seen that in Western New York very recently, that Blue Cross Blue Shield of Western New York just recently dropped, I can't remember the number, I think it was three different plans that were Medicaid or other low-income plans for child health coverage, but that's following suit in things that have happened already in central New York in past years. So this is a bit, it's a different trend, right? It's a plans that already exist in New York and that people can get other plans, other options. But then when you look at other states, they just didn't expand the program. So there's just less options altogether for people in that income bracket.
Exactly.
And even where we have more enrollment and there's more insured, it doesn't necessarily mean more access. So clearly, if there's not medical providers and there's a workforce issue in these regions, having insurance doesn't solve the problem.
Right.
In addition to that, many of the...
you're talking about the practitioner shortage generally?
Absolutely.
Right.
And for geriatricians, there's 7,000 geriatricians or 7,200 geriatricians in the United States, 56 million people over age 65, and 10,000 more every day. And many of these are in rural communities, and probably the fastest growing population in these rural communities is over age 85. So that's one issue. The other issue is many of the poorest poor are choosing, when they are going into ACA plans, they're choosing the bronze plans, which have very high co-pays and deductibles.
Right.
And in those instances, what it essentially means is that they're no pay for the very first portion of their health care. And unless they have something catastrophic happen, they're still not going for very basic care.
Right. So assuming that's also limiting their access to say, more preventative services as well.
Absolutely. And then on top of that, healthcare systems that are picking up these patients are actually writing off those first part of the healthcare. So if they have a $5,000 deductible for their hospital stay that the patient cannot pay, they're going to write that off. That doesn't go into their disproportionate share and some of the other reimbursement mechanisms for covering that, because they look insured from the government standpoint. And now you have health systems that are really on the edge of financial solvency going down because the patients can't pay their share. So it's nice that you can compare these plans and that everything's standardized and that they have access, but access to the plan doesn't mean actually access to the care.
Right. And in fact, that point's made in this other cut from Kathleen Hempstead from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We'll just play this as we're fast running out of time in this pretty interesting discussion around rural healthcare on Healthy Friday. Here's Kathleen Hempstead from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, just talking more about what they've uncovered in terms of the data coming in about affordable healthcare coverage, particularly in rural areas.
We have a really rich data set that we collected that has a whole lot of cost-sharing information on every single silver plan that's available in the market in 2014. And one of the things that our grantee did at the University of Pennsylvania, really did the research, is they analyzed that data to look at differences in premiums for residents of rural counties versus residents of urban counties. And one of the things they really found was that it tended to be the case that the biggest differences were between states that had a lot of rural residents versus states that didn't. So the within-state differences between rural and urban weren't that great, but when they compared states where a higher proportion of the eligible population was rural to states where a higher proportion of the eligible population was urban, the more rural states were, in general, having a higher average premium.
I'm looking at some comparisons by some other studies, and I'm just wondering, it looks a little bit different by some of the stats that I'm looking at. Maybe you can explain to me, if there's a confusion here. Just looking at Monroe County, Ontario, Wayne County, that's we group that as one group. We're seeing, if you go to the southern tier, for example, $64 more for the bronze plan, $69 typically more for the silver. So we're seeing in New York State a big change between counties. But I wonder if when you're averaging it across the state, if it comes out a little bit differently. Maybe you can clear that up for me.
Yeah, I mean, our study was national. So it looked at, you know, all of the rural and urban counties in the whole country and in general found that the biggest differences were between more and less rural states rather than within rural and urban areas within particular states. But that doesn't mean that that's necessarily what you're going to see in any particular state. And New York is a state where a relatively low proportion of the exchange-eligible residents live in rural counties.
So when you're looking at this, what is this going to mean as far as health outcomes for people in different places in the country? And I wonder if the states that bought into the marketplaces and had their own exchanges really differed as well for similar reasons from one state to another.
You know, that's a really good question, and I think it's really way too soon to say how that's going to play out. I mean, there certainly seemed like there were some states where there was relatively little participation by carriers as compared to others, but we see in many, many states that a lot of carriers are entering, and we see that, you know, in states that had their own exchanges and states that used healthcare.gov. I mean, one thing that did come up with, you know, in our study comparing the rural to the urban counties was that, in general, residents of rural counties had fewer choices of plans, you know, which is not surprising because, you know, there's just sort of a smaller market, so there's fewer carriers and there's fewer plans to choose from. But they were less likely to have a narrow network plan as their choice. So in some ways, it could be the case that provider networks may be a bit broader in rural areas, even though that has to be tempered by the fact that there are fewer providers overall.
What does that mean when it comes down to coverage for these individuals? Because in some other studies, part of the conversation is whether people have coverage or not, they may not use it, either because of accessibility of hospitals and providers or just the cost of using the plan that they've purchased.
Well, I mean, that's a problem that has been coming up all over the country, and it's, you know, it's more of a problem for some people than others, but I mean, people have in, you know, in rural and urban areas have been finding that they can't necessarily find providers who are actually willing to accept their insurance, even if those providers are listed on the carrier's website. So that's kind of an endemic issue that, you know, people have been talking about and that, you know, carriers are really need to do some work on. You know, there have been some other issues in more sort of sparsely populated places about narrow networks and access. Like, you may be familiar with some of the issues that came up in New Hampshire, where a lot of hospitals were excluded from some of the plans, and people really pushed back a lot. But one of the things that's happening in 2015 is we're seeing a lot of carriers are entering the market, and I think that's going to bring consumers more choice.
Whether it be in rural areas or in urban areas, one thing that we've been seeing in New York State is some of the health plans are dropping Medicaid and other low-income coverage that they once carried. We're seeing that a lot in central New York near Albany, and we've just seen it a couple of places around the Buffalo area. I wonder if that's something that we're seeing nationwide as well, and if that has any play on the urban-rural issue and spread.
You know, I haven't heard about that. And in fact, I was just talking to someone from another state that said a carrier was entering to offer a Medicaid offering. So I don't necessarily think that that's part of a national plan. I mean, I think at the end of the day, it probably has a lot to do with the reimbursement rates that carriers and providers are negotiating and whether providers are willing to accept them.
Catherine Hempstead from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, with about 2 minutes left on today's Healthy Friday. Thanks to all our guests, and I'll credit them again just before we sign off. Jim Kennedy, I was just wanting to ask you about, do you think there's still some corrections to be seen? You know, new enrollment period opening November 15th, and, you know, it seems pretty critical in some of these marketplaces that there's sort of like a real third health fund in the game to be able to sort of offer, you know, make sure people have, you know, access to sufficient choices for coverage.
Yeah, we have a real challenge and a real responsibility, Matthew, to make sure that our patients, existing, new ones, and prospective ones, stay engaged with their healthcare providers. So whether you're a health center or a private practitioner, it behooves us to be customer-focused, certainly be data-focused now in this new accountable era that we're entering, and to do so in a way that is transparent to the payers, which is, you know, the insurance companies, the health insurers, and the technology is requiring that of us. But happily, as some of the other speakers have said, our patients now have choices. They have more choices than they did before, and that will require us providers to be more customer, more patient-focused, and that's all to the good.
Jim Kennedy from the New York State Association for Rural Health. Erica Zilla, just a quick closing comment from you, perhaps about what you think remains to be kind of discovered about the Affordable Care Act with rural communities.
Well, I think that as Catherine was saying, there's some evidence that rural people may have had more choices available to them as a result of the Affordable Care Act, that some plans came into the market that hadn't been there before. And, you know, in general, within states, most states didn't seem the kind of see the kind of differences that Michelle reported in New York between counties, between the rural and urban counties, although some did. But I think the big question remains, so what's going to happen next year? We've certainly heard stories in various parts of the country of I guess that means I need to stop.
We are out of time. Thanks
I'm
so much.
The music.
Indeed. Very, very good. Erica Zilla is a Senior Research Associate and Deputy Director at the Maine Rural Health Research Center at the Muskie School of Public Health. She's contributed a chapter to Access to Medical Care in Rural America, published by Springer in New York. And also out of time, sadly, but thanks so much for being with us, is Dr. Daniel Mendelson from the Division of Geriatrics at the Department of Medicine Highland Hospital here in Rochester. Thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Mendelson. This has been Healthy Friday. I'm Matthew Leonard from the Innovation Trail. Michelle Faust from WXX iNews has been here with me in the studio as well. Please go to WXXI.org and have a look for the Take the Affordable Care Act survey if you'd like to. Let us know what you're thinking about the Affordable Care Act. And Evan is back on Monday looking at the impact of the riots in Ferguson, and what that means for Rochester's community. Thanks for being with us.